you out there in podcast land. This is the Front Row Network. I'm your host, Brandon Davis, and this is our November edition of Front Row Classics. There's a lot of things to be thankful for this month. There aren't a lot of classics that have to do with Thanksgiving, so I just picked a movie that I'm thankful for. And I've always been thankful for John Huston's The African Queen. This is one I've wanted to get around to for quite a while, and I'm glad I finally get to. And I have two great guests with me here on this podcast. I have joining me for the third month in a row, Eric Flick. Hey, Eric.
Hey, Brandon. How are you?
Awesome. How's it going?
It's going really well. I too am excited about discussing this definitely classic movie.
Yes, absolutely. Dracula, you can make an argument for or against, but this one I don't think you can. So, and also joining me again for, it's been a while. I can't remember the last time we had him on a classic, but Craig McFarland. Hey, Craig.
It has been a while, and I have to remember that I have to take this way more seriously than my own show. So I need to make sure I'm focused, because you guys are good at what you do. And so I always have to step up my game, which is why I stay away as long as possible.
Wow. We like to have fun, though.
We do.
You do.
I'm just glad I could pull you away from Disney Plus for a little bit.
Only because this is the Jungle Cruise, the movie, yes, right?
It really is.
The old bait and switch. We got you
really,
on this one.
It really is. This is a movie I think everybody needs to see before the Jungle Cruise comes out.
So. Absolutely.
Yeah, so we will, for anyone who's not familiar, The African Queen from 1951 takes place right at the onset of World War I in Uganda. Humphrey Bogart plays Charlie Allnut, who is the skipper of a supply boat called The African Queen, where he goes and takes supplies to all the various villages. Due to a certain tragedy and her brother passing away, a missionary played by Katharine Hepburn needs to get back to the mainland, and Charlie reluctantly agrees to take her on this journey with him. And basically it is two people who never in real life would ever spend that much time together being forced to survive together in a situation and end up not only liking each other but falling in love. And it's a classic romance adventure story. Eric, I know that this is one of your favorites. Do you remember the first time you saw it?
I saw this probably in the late 90s, because it had shown up on one of the lists, you know, one of the probably AFI's top 100 movies. And it wasn't one I was too familiar with. But when that list came out, I sort of made an effort to go find a lot of these movies. And it's tough to go wrong when you're pairing Humphrey Bogart with Katharine Hepburn in a John Huston film. So, you put all those elements together and you get a really memorable movie here.
It's the only time they work together. And it's the American Film Institute also did a list in the late 90s of like the 25 greatest men and the 25 greatest women of the golden age of Hollywood. And these two were number one on those respective lists. So the only time they work together, and it's really, it's one of those times where you have a starring vehicle where both of the stars are of the exact same magnitude. I think they both have equal star power, which is kind of rare. You don't always
get that.
So, Craig, I think this is more of a recent movie. Was this your first viewing of it?
I had seen it maybe about a year ago. You let me borrow the Blu-ray for a very long time. And I did get to see it then. And I'm kind of living back through all these classics through you, sir, because you're telling me the movies that I've always missed. And just, it's really interesting because, and I know we're going to get into the performances and all that, but truly is just a two-person piece, really. I mean, you obviously have some action at the beginning and some action at the end as far as other characters being involved. But for the big chunk of this movie, it's really just kind of a masterclass in how you propel a plot along with only two characters. And it's just really interesting to appreciate the acting that is put into this film.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this movie, it would be a totally different movie if you had cast different people in the roles. I think the main ingredient of this movie is the chemistry between Bogart and Hepburn. There's just something about the way they play these characters and just the naturalness of the two of them. Really interesting because neither one of them had played characters like these before. You know, Bogart, audiences were used to seeing him as a cool, collected, always together character. They were used to seeing him as the sort of, you know, dirty, drunk, vulnerable type character. And Katharine Hepburn, this is the first time she's ever played sort of a spinster, a grand lady. And she, of course, she would make a career in her later life of playing those. But she usually played modern career women. And so this was the first time both of them kind of were playing, you know, their age. They both were getting older, but they both rose to the occasion. And this is also one of the very first times where a location shooting was really sort of being made in the forefront of a movie, where half of this movie, you can tell, was shot in Uganda. And I don't think it would have been the same movie if they hadn't shot it on location either.
Absolutely. And I mean, it even says that right at the end. It's like shot in Africa. Can I make a weird parallel to a more modern day film? Sure. This is a go with me here, guys. So you have two just world-class caliber actors, and they are both Oscar winners already at this point. Correct, Brandon? They've already won their Oscars.
No, but Bogart is only Oscar for this movie.
Okay, sorry. But the parallel I would make for it is watching the film Fences with Denzel Washington and Viola Davis, because really, again, that's just another film that's a more modern play brought to a film, but it's again, a master class in just how acting and those two characters can really drive a story. Even though Viola Davis ended up winning Best Supporting Actress in that year, how that worked, I'm not sure, but no, it's really interesting when you can see two powerhouses really carry a full film like this and earn their money.
Yeah, and Brandon, you mentioned sort of Bogart's previous roles, and he was obviously a favorite of John Huston's.
Yes,
and I think you can't discuss this movie without discussing the director a lot. I think this is really his vision, and I'm not sure if he did or didn't, but was likely the producer of the film too. At this point in his career, in John Huston's career, he's just a force of nature in Hollywood, could pretty much do whatever he wants. So the casting decision, though, for a Humphrey Bogart, who has to play this buck-toothed, gassy, drunk riverboat captain, the first time I saw this movie, it was jarring. You know, at first you see Humphrey Bogart and you're like, what happened to him? Yeah. He let himself go. But he very quickly settles into that role. And I think it's well-deserved that this is his only Academy Award. I mean, when you think of the memorable characters that he had played prior to this is late in his career. I mean, this is after the Maltese Falcon and Casablanca and all the other great roles that he had that he didn't win anything for. But when you watch him in this and how he transforms himself, you realize that, he was deserving this Academy Award for this film.
Yeah, you mentioned John Huston, and we'll talk about him a lot. But he and Bogart had the kind of pairing that you think of when you think of like Johnny Depp and Tim Burton, or De Niro with Scorsese, or John Wayne with John Ford. They were just a perfect sort of actor director pairing. And you know, the first movie John Huston ever directed was Maltese Falcon. And that was sort of what shot Bogart into superstardom as well. So their careers kind of paralleled each other. I love John Huston. I respect John Huston because he wrote and directed most of his own stuff, or at least co-wrote with other people. Yeah. So his movies, at a time when studios were very controlling of even directors, most of his movies are very much his own vision. And he's doing that within the confines of like a studio system. What's interesting about The African Queen, though, is it's really an indie movie with two major stars and, you know, a major director. It's produced by a guy named Sam Spiegel, who took this actually to a British company and they financed it because really no studio wanted to touch this project. This movie had sort of been sitting on studio shelves for decades because it's an old book. It's from like the 1910s, I believe, or something like that. And so
it was right after World War One ended, right? So
it had just been kind of sitting on a shelf for a while, but when you think about the era that this was made, this is right at the start of McCarthyism, and you've got Bogart, Hepburn, and Huston, all three who were very much known at the time as very liberal-leaning celebrities, and all of whom had kind of gotten into trouble for things that they had said. This was some kind of a good excuse for them to get away from the U.S. for a little while and let things kind of simmer down for them and just sort of be in Uganda for a few months. Like I said, the whole Red Scare going on in Hollywood very much plays into this going into production as well. So a lot of stuff surrounding this movie.
Yeah. And it's funny going to Uganda for a few months to get away from, having to go to, testify in front of the Senate or something like that seems like a good idea, but there've been books written and movies made about the troubleshooting this movie too.
Yes.
I think it's pretty ironic that the plot of the movie is sort of the classic man versus nature narrative. And literally the making of this movie, I think, was a man versus nature narrative too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Let's get in though. First, let's just talk about, the two leads a little bit more and, the characters and favorite scenes and all that stuff. Let's start with Bogart as Charlie Allnut. I've said it before several times on this podcast, but Bogart to me was just the perfect movie actor. I think that if you read books and you hear stories about people, they would say, you know, just an ordinary guy, if you were to talk to him in real life, but something happened to him when you put him in front of a camera and he was just electric. And there's just something about him that even to this day feels modern to me. He doesn't seem like he's been plucked out of the 40s or the 50s. He's very much timeless. I think you could put Bogart in any movie today and he would seem modern. Almost.
Yeah, that's an interesting take. And he works hard in this one. There's a lot of, Craig, you mentioned it. It's two people. So it's a lot of intimate scenes with, in close quarters with one other, actor, and a lot of close tight shots on what they're doing. And he brings it. And, I already said it a few minutes ago. He warranted the Academy Award that he got for this one.
Absolutely. And, you know, I just think it's interesting that you've got two actors that are on diverging paths, essentially, because his character is so cocky at the beginning. And then towards the end, you finally start to see the emotions come in and the fear come in, gripping him towards the end, where they're stuck in the marsh and he has no idea if they're actually going to make it out. And whereas Hepburn's character, you see her go from this reserved, quiet person to truly helping get them through that hard situation through just sheer will. Right. So it's interesting because I liked his character a lot at the beginning with the cockiness, but I think I liked him even more when he was showing a vulnerable side towards the latter half of the film. And he was able to convey that in a way that really propelled his character throughout the whole movie.
Yeah. And he goes from, cocky to confidently strong and does that really well, you know, where, he becomes, and I'm sure we'll get to favorite scenes of the movie, but the way they set this up so that his character arc where he transforms and he shows that change in his personality really happens at a couple of key points. And the scene where he gets himself drunk is really a transformational scene. He goes from this sort of cocky guy to who realizes he's going to get shown up by this woman and he's got to apologize to her and does. And there's a real transformation in his character. To the guy that falls in love with this woman and then realizes that it's up to him to pull her out of this very dangerous situation that they've gotten themselves into. And there's a great scene where that happens that we can discuss later. it's a great arc for him.
I love how you really know who he is right from the minute he steps on screen. You don't have to have a whole lot of exposition on him. The way he's dressed, the way he presents himself, just that first scene with him, with Hepburn and her brother, you know, with the, you know, the stomach growling and, you know, him just being sort of unkempt and everything. You know exactly who this guy is. He's authentic. He's not really putting on any kind of airs. And even though he's not, he's sort of put up this wall, you know, has to do with, you know, certainly, you know, all the alcohol in the beginning, but, just little by little, those walls are being torn down really for both of them toward the whole length of the movie. But yeah, he really, what I love is Bogart isn't afraid to show his vulnerable side in this movie, which a lot of times you don't see in a whole lot of other performances because he plays everything so cool most of the time. But he's not afraid to really show emotions in this role and everything. And I think this is one of, you know, certainly one of his top three performances in my mind, just because it's a fully rounded character with such a complete arc, as you said, Eric.
Yeah. I mean, I guess if there were one hole in it, doing some research, the original novel, everyone's British. They had to change him to Canadian because he couldn't do the accent. So they were like, well, we need a subject of the Queen still. So he's got to be Canadian. So
and then just maybe just a little bit over a decade later, Dick Van Dyke threw that out the window and decided it didn't matter at all if he couldn't do a Cockney accent. So.
Well, that's the one that even in the very last scene when the German officials are asking him what nationality he is, it's very jarring when he says British because there's no hint of it at all. He's totally comes across as American this whole time.
Yeah, but yeah, absolutely.
But I guess he didn't want to end up on the list of the worst accents like Dick Van Dyke did. So,
wise choice.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about Hepburn. Once again, another character who has just a great arc about her. She's totally got her guard up and full of, not really snooty, but she just has, this air about her that's sort of untouched. And, I love Hepburn said that she really had a hard time getting hold of the character in the beginning and finally just went up to John Huston and said, I just don't know how you want me to play this. And finally he said, Huston apparently just whispered Eleanor Roosevelt in her ear and she said, ah, got it. She had it for the rest of the time. But Hepburn, like Bogart's one of my favorites, but she is so great. I just love I love as she gets more and more confident as she's learning how to drive the boat and all of that, and just the giddy joy that she's experiencing in those early scenes.
And yeah, those early scenes with this character are great. She's got a quiet confidence. It's her plan. I mean, once they get on the boat, she immediately wants revenge for the Germans that burned down the village. So, the strength of her character comes out, but she's also not afraid to be vulnerable there at the beginning, where she's asking all sorts of questions. She doesn't understand why he doesn't clean the engine, fix the thing, all the things that would just, you know, as this missionary, just come naturally to her. And the way that she plays it, so having the cognitive dissonance of being uptight, but then willing to do whatever it takes at the same time is really kind of masterful there too.
And to me, like she shows the most change even more so than Bogart's character, just because like you mentioned the giddiness. And I love the scene where they get out of the whitewater and they're talking back and forth. And, Bogart's characters there, she said something like, well, I never dreamed of doing that. And he goes, I know, but it's okay to be scared. And she was like, no, I never dreamed of feeling this alive, or, you know, something to that effect. And it was just kind of like, no, idiot, I'm not scared. I had a great time on those white waters. And it's cool because up to that point in the film, you really have seen her very much reserved and, you know, trying to sing along with a terrible choir. So it's kind of nice to see her loosen up a little bit. And that's kind of the start of building that relationship and that trust between the two characters. And it was very evident. This is a film that would be easily studyable in film school, right? As far as character development and relationships in screenwriting.
Yeah, totally. The script, I think, is pretty. What I love about this movie is it works as a piece of cinema, and it also works as a piece of great popcorn entertainment. And somehow Houston and James Agee, who wrote the script, were just able to walk that balance perfectly. It's something that both critics and the popular audiences can like at the same time. And I mean, mainly it's because they cast the right people, but also because it gets you on a human level, just the whole journey of it and all of that. And I think it's mainly due to these two performances.
Yeah. And you start to feel feel the compassion, like even when it starts raining and she's trying to keep him out of the sheltered area of the boat. And then she's like, no, you can come in here. You know, just little bits like that help build along that relationship and that trust.
And I was going to say, Brandon, going along with what you were saying about it being a popular movie, there's points in the movie where the score is this jaunty, happy, comedic Disney 1950s score. And you're not quite sure what kind of movie you're watching at that point. You know, is this going to be a lighthearted romp down a river, or is this going to turn into Deliverance? You're not real sure what's going to happen in this movie. And it skillfully navigates all of that too. There's comedic parts to it. It's a romance and it's an adventure. It's really skillfully put together from the script perspective too. And I think that really gave those actors a lot to work with too. So you give them all of those elements and you take great actors and you throw them into that, and it's a recipe for success.
Well, and there's a great documentary on the Blu-ray where they show an older interview from the 80s with John Huston. And he said, I really hadn't figured on it being so funny. It was just the way he said that Bogey and Kate were playing it. And he said, so because they were playing it that way, I had them play it up. And apparently, you know, and I'm not sure exactly in the actual novel, but in the script, the two characters were supposed to die at the end. I'm not sure if it was that they were supposed to be hung or if, you know, they were going to drown after the boat got torpedoed or whatever. But which was a typical Houston type movie. He loved, you know, lovable losers who don't win in the end. But he said because of the way it was being played and because they were making these characters so lovable, he's like, he changed his mind right there in Africa. He said, no, Charlie and Rosie can't die. So they made the switch. And I you know, that once again, great guts on his part just to make that switch and say, you know, right in the middle of filming. But yeah, like I said, it's, I love it because there's some really terrible things that happen to them along the way, but because of the way they play it, it never gets depressing. I never feel depressed watching this movie, even though there's a moment where, you know, they've sort of resigned to themselves that they're going to die. You know, you're comfortable because they make you comfortable.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So let's move on here. Let's talk about some favorite scenes. There's a lot of great moments in this movie. We'll start with you, Craig. What's one of your favorites?
Well, I definitely would say the whitewater that I mentioned, that's a favorite. I have to kind of laugh. This is kind of a weird scene to have as a favorite scene, but it reminded me of where we were time-wise when this was being filmed, when he gets the leeches all over him. Mm-hmm. And he takes off his shirt and she's like putting salt all over him. And then he goes, get my legs. And he lifted it up to like his shins. Like apparently there's no leeches above his shins. Like it was just, for some reason that just cracked me up. Like, going back and watching it again this weekend, we're definitely in the 50s here, you know, cause here he is like taking off his shirt to, it just hit me. It just had me cracking up that his leeches only went up to like right mid-level shin. You know, we couldn't go any higher than that. You know,
he didn't want to show his 50-year-old butt, probably.
I have to say that's one of my favorite scenes in the movie too. And that's one of the moments though, where the strength of Charlie Allnut comes out, because they have this moment of absolute panic. And he even says they poisoned my blood, and he knows he's going to get extremely sick from this. And they get the leeches off, and there's a moment where they go back to work and the ship just gets stuck once more. Mm-hmm. And the absolute stone-faced resignation that he has as he just hops back into that water where he just got covered in leeches to finish the mission, to do the work for the woman that he loves, is to me just it shows so much about his character. And then it immediately transitions to the next scene where she's in the water, and you mm-hmm. realize these guys are absolutely in this together. And it kind of hit me kind of hard, as like these two are willing to do whatever it takes to fulfill their perceived duty at that point. So I love that scene.
See, while I'm over here laughing, Eric's like, this is true human devotion. But, you know, it is great that they do the pull away shot as well. Like, so you've got this despair, right? And just they pull up and they're like, what, like 30 feet away from the edge of that marshy area, and it just kills you. You're like, oh, yeah. You're right there, you know? And so, of course, the rain ends up being the hero, which I still don't quite understand how that works, but we'll let movie magic.
Deus ex machina, you know? Classic Greek literature.
That's right. But no, it was definitely all building towards that climax of the movie, where you think, are these two going to perish in this? Is this where it's going to end?
Well, Chris, don't feel bad. The parts that I laugh at in this movie, there are two great scenes, and they're Katharine Hepburn scenes in my mind. So the first one where they're taking baths, and again, 1950s, they're in long underwear, so you're not seeing anything.
Right.
But just the physical sort of humor of watching her try to get back in the boat is mm-hmm. really just a delight. You know, she's got a hold of a rope and her feet go up above her head, and she still can't get herself into the boat. It made me laugh out loud. It was just a physically funny scene. But even
another example of her showing the control later on. You know, it shows that she's comfortable with the boat. She's jumped right into the water and all of that. We don't see her get out again, but you don't assume that it's like quite the folly that it was to get her in the first time. So, sorry, I interrupted you, but I do agree that it shows again that building of character.
Yeah, but the second one is when she's decided that she's had enough of Charlie Allnut being a drunk. And so he wakes up after his long night of drinking gin. And I guess I love too, the fact that he just takes the glass, dips it in the river, and that's his mixer for the gin drink that he's going to have. It was this, you know, iced tea colored water that he's pulled out of the river. But you see her emptying these bottles, and the shot that pans away that sees all of these Gordon's gin bottles floating behind them in the trail is just a great shot too.
Yeah, absolutely. And it did. Like, I immediately went to the bacteria that was in that glass when he just pulled that out of the water. Oh man. It took me back to Oregon Trail. I thought for sure one of them was going to have dysentery and die. Sure. Along the way, well, you know,
well, Katharine Hepburn and the whole crew did get dysentery while filming this. I don't know if you.
Of course they did.
She said it's funny. She said John Huston and Bogart would just drink whiskey the whole time, and I used to say I'm not going to drink that because I'm traveling with two drunks and someone's got to keep their head about them. So she said I drank a lot of the water, and for being self righteous, she said I almost died because that water was poison. And she said so that scene where she's playing the organ. At the very beginning, she said she had a bucket next to her. Whenever they would cut, she would vomit into the bucket.
Because
she said she and like half the crew were indisposed for about a day and a half. Just because
she looked miserable in that scene. So now that all comes together.
Yeah. And if you look, they said, if you look closely, her face is about sunken in because she's so dehydrated in that scene. But yeah, I mean, a lot of stuff. And you talked about the leeches. They wanted to use real leeches. Bogart wouldn't. So they found some kind of like rubbery thing that was able to stick to his skin finally. But I love, he is so, I mean, and to use Jeremy's word, that's an iconic scene that people talked about for years after that. And I think it's mainly just his reaction to the leeches, to see this big tough guy just be reduced to this shivering, you know, little kid almost. Is really, really great. I also love the scene where they're just being swarmed by the flies, and to see like the madness that can happen when something like that occurs, because Katharine Hepburn just becomes this sort of, you know, screaming, you know, mad woman until they finally, you know, throw the blanket over her and he sacrifices himself to do that. I love the scene where he finally has gotten himself sober and they're finally starting to get to know one another. And they've been together on this boat for a couple of days and she doesn't even know what his first name is. And she asks him and he says, Charlie. I love that whole little bit where they're realizing, you know, we've known each other all this time, but now we're finally starting to get to know each other. And it's playing out like so real. Cause you can know people in real life in certain ways. And then you finally start to uncover that there's a real human being underneath. I just love the way that whole scene plays out.
Yeah, well, how many of us know a lot of people by their last name only, right? You know, and someone that you're in more of a professional relationship with, if it's like a kid's teacher or something like that, you know, you don't necessarily know their first name, and that's not how you address them. And I went through that working at the same college that I was a student at. You know, everybody was Dr. So-and-so for the longest time. Yeah. So it's like you finally get to know them as a person as opposed to just a profession.
I like those little bits that happen all throughout the movie. So there are those things where as they get more and more intimate, the formal language breaks down. He doesn't call her Mist. You know, he ends up calling her My Rosie and good old gal and those types of, you know, really sweet terms of endearment. And then to see like the clothing, when she gets on the boat, she's got the really wide brimmed sun bonnet scarf. Her dress is all the way up to her chin. And all of those things just break down over time too. And I think that's just a really clever choice. And all of those things just show you the transition from when they started to when they ended, what that journey did to them and how their relationship grew in that too. I thought they were real clever choices.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And really, I think because, as you all said, because this is such a two-person piece and it all kind of plays out just like one long scene, that it mainly is made up of moments that you love. And and there's like great shots. Like you said, the shots of all the gin bottles floating away, or the shot when they raise above the marshes and you see how close they are to the lake, things like that. And I just love, once again, Houston, the way he shoots it. You can feel the heat, you can feel the discomfort, you can feel all of that just by the way he gets the close-ups of them and all of that. And I just love how he really took the time to really show you that they were really there. I mean, there's sometimes, you know, when they do the rapids, they're clearly in front of a green screen, but there's other times where, you know, you clearly see they're there and there's, you know, the crocodiles next to them and all of that. I love that. And it was so unusual for a movie made at that time.
Well, it had to be hard to shoot. There's so much that you can tell is natural lighting that they had to get it in that take because the sun was moving on them. So this had to have been such an immensely difficult project, especially for that time. Like you said, people didn't go on location and shoot movies at this time. So this was pioneering in that way.
how much easier would this all have been if they just had drones, right? You know, I mean, yeah. Like, it would have made it so much easier.
Well, and they said they had there's the actual boat, the African Queen. Then they had to make two more pontoons, one for the starboard side and one for the other side, and so that you could get close-ups, because they said you couldn't fit a Technicolor camera on the African Queen because it was so small in size. And those Technicolor cameras were huge because they had three strips of film running in them each. And anytime you would run out of film, you would have to change three of them again. And then apparently Hepburn had in her contract, she had to have her own personal bathroom and one behind there. And apparently one time it got stuck in the reeds because they had gone too far. And so they just had to cut it loose one day and go back and get it. But they said, and you couldn't predict what the current was. And so sometimes you get swept out farther than you wanted to. And so, yeah, I can't imagine just the discomfort and the annoying, you know, the annoying time wasting that would go on during this time.
Well, ask Steven Spielberg about shooting films on the water. He will probably tell you that it is a mess.
He at least had a couple more decades of technological advances on them, though. But
fair.
And that, to me, that's one of the other great scenes in this movie are the ones where Bogart goes under the boat to fix the iron pieces, the rod and the propeller fins. They're shot really well for this time period. You know, you don't really see a whole lot of underwater shots. So
yeah, well, and those were shot on a soundstage in England because the water was so dangerous they wouldn't let them go in the water. So that's shot in like an underwater tank they had on the which. But yeah, I mean it's crystal clear. I mean normally something like that would be more blurry.
Yeah.
Any more favorite sequences that you can think of?
I mean, the marriage execution scene at the end. You know, I now announce you man and wife. Now resume the execution. I mean that's a heck of a line to nearly end your film on. So it was well played, and I would imagine that there were a couple of outtakes there for some laughs.
What I love, yeah, it's a totally implausible ending, but you still go with it. You still believe it because nobody's playing it. Nobody's winking to the camera. It's all being played straight. And so, yeah, you just go with it. I'm trying to think what my other favorite. Well, the one thing that sticks out to me is when some of the German officers are talking, you clearly see that someone else is dubbing their voice. I mean, there's a couple of them where they're speaking, but like, if you really pay attention, you can totally see it's not their own voice and somebody else with a stronger accent is talking, or maybe they had too strong of an accent and someone's trying to speak for them. But to me, that's really one of the only thing that dates this movie.
Yeah. There are some of the shots of the animals that aren't quite as seamless. You know, that those were shots, those animals weren't anywhere close to that boat. You know, the fact that they look off the side of the boat and, oh, there just happens to be giraffes next to lions, next to hippopotamus. I mean, that's all stuff that is a little suspension of disbelief. Mm-hmm. The other scene that if we wanted to be nitpicky about it, the very last scene where they're floating, they're in the lake. Both ships are at the bottom of the lake at this point, and they're floating. If you listen to the dialogue, you can tell they're in a swimming pool. I mean, you can just hear the sound bouncing off and coming back, and it's like, wow, I guess they didn't shoot that one on location. That one's done somewhere in London. So.
Yeah, we kind of veered over. Craig, I mean, Eric and I both said anything other that doesn't work for you.
I mean, you know, I enjoyed the film. I don't think that there's anything in particular that comes across, maybe other than the leeches and the shins. But outside of that, I think that it's a very well done picture, especially for 1951, and some really great performances.
Yeah, absolutely.
What does work for me, hijacking your show, I am so happy this was made just 4 years before Disneyland, because basically Walt just said, oh, this is a great movie. I'm going to steal it and I'm going to put it in my park. So he made the Jungle Cruise based off of this. And in fact, he wanted to have live animals as part of the Jungle Cruise. And his Imagineer said, whoa, wait a minute. Let's hold on there. So they ended up making them animatronics. But it is really cool. It's a great tie-in to the fact that Emily Blunt and Dwayne The Rock Johnson look very much like Bogart and Hepburn in this film, in the Jungle Cruise coming out. We hope that it's a really good film. And hopefully it doesn't end up as a Guilty Pleasures crossover, but maybe more of a Classics crossover with Beyond the Mouse.
Is Dwayne Johnson, is it his time now? I mean, he's about the same point in his career that Bogart was. So maybe Academy Award for Dwayne Johnson for Jungle Cruise, right?
You know, he is really taking it seriously from everything that you've read. I think he understands that there is a certain expectation when it comes to this film in particular. He actually came out, Brett was there at the panel at D23. He came out on the Jungle Cruise boat and onto the stage and said how much the fans of Disney appreciate this ride and so how seriously they're taking it. From all accounts, it seems like he's really into this. He's producing a show for Disney Plus that's going to be all about the classic attractions. So that'll be coming out in the future as well. And I think that he's really buying into this. So the Tooth Fairy has come very far, and hopefully he does make some moves here. If it is a combination of the African Queen meets Jumanji, this movie will be great. I mean, that would be just a perfect, because if people haven't watched Jumanji, I held off for the longest time, but it is incredible. It's a great
film. You're talking
film.
About the 2018 one.
Yeah, the new one.
2018 that he came out with. Yeah.
It's great.
It is good.
Well, also, luckily for him, he doesn't have to get to the African Queen because they made a little movie called The Haunted Mansion. All he's got to do is get above that. And so,
there was a couple of Pirates movies that weren't that great either.
But. Yeah. Well, also, I mean, you were talking about how it inspired Disney, but really this created kind of a genre. I mean, you can see where, you know, Spielberg took elements for the Indiana Jones movies from this. You can see where something like Romancing the Stone, you know, where you do these action adventures with, you know, a male female lead where they're antagonistic toward each other in the beginning and then, you know, fall in love. You know, this was kind of the blueprint for all of that. It's funny looking at, you know, some more trivia here though. Apparently, there was no place to put the crew, so the set designer actually had to build cabins for 40 people there in the middle of the jungle out of bamboo. And apparently one day after coming back from filming, soldier ants had made residence in the cabins. So they basically had to dig a hole and light some kerosene and blow everything up to get rid of those soldier ants. But yeah, it doesn't... And then John Huston, who was a very well-known person who liked to tell tall tales, said that they hired a guy who would go out and shoot game for them so they would have something to eat every day. And he said, whenever we would get off, surely there was some meat in the pot. And he said, although one day this guy disappeared and they found out a few days later he was arrested because apparently there were villagers that kept disappearing when he would go out. So, so they said he was later hung, but on the documentary, they talked to a couple of the crew and they said, yeah, that's just a bunch of bull. They said he lied about that for decades.
Nice.
So I've never seen this movie, but in 1990, Clint Eastwood put out a movie called White Hunter, Black Heart. And Brandon, you're shaking your head like are you familiar with this movie and have you seen it?
I haven't, not all the way through, but I've seen bits of it. But I know it's hard to get your hands on. I've tried to look for it. I think it's streaming somewhere. But yeah, apparently Eastwood is the sort of a John Huston type character.
And yeah, then, so it's a sort of a fictionalized account of the making of the African Queen. Which, I mean, how many movies have another movie, another entire movie made about them, about the making of that movie.
I hear that. African Queen of Mary Poppins, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then looking at, you know, how it was released, it was kind of put together sort of hastily at the last minute because the producer, Sam Spiegel, it was supposed to be released worldwide in February, but he wanted it to be an Oscar contender. So they rushed it and they booked it to play one theater the last week of December in 1951 so it could be eligible for Oscars. So so same thing goes on today. But
yeah, you mean that happened then too?
So, but it ended up getting four nominations, Best Actor, Actress, Screenplay, and Director. Didn't get Best Picture nomination. But Bogart won, and apparently Bogart was up against Brando for Streetcar Named Desire for this. So Bogart said, I'm not winning. And so apparently in the limo on the way to the theater, he and his wife, Lauren Bacall, were riding with a friend, and the friend said, well, what are you going to do if you win? He said, I'm not going to win. I don't care. It doesn't matter. And he said, well, if you do win, because he'd been nominated several times before and all this, he said, go up, take a long, hard minute looking at the Oscar. It'll seem like an hour, and just say, it's about time, and walk off the stage. And so apparently then they called Bogart's name, and they said, and this was back in a time where the Oscars, where everyone kind of kept their composure and there wasn't a whole lot of, scenes made or whatever. They said when Bogart's name was announced, the place went crazy because the town just respected him so much. And so they said he got up there and he got so emotional and flustered. They said he thanked everybody and everything. And the guy afterwards said, well, why didn't you say what you were going to say? And he said, tell you what, when you finally win an Oscar, you do it.
That's great. That's a great story about him.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, he one of the few guys who I think you rarely heard a bad word about from anybody. They said, despite his tough guy image, he was a gentleman. But yeah, made, you know, number 17 on the AFI list in 1998, number 14 on the greatest romances, 48 on the greatest adventures. So yeah, just a widely respected movie. And I don't think it dates. I think it still plays as well as it did then.
Yeah. And you know, you've got the element too of it being a wartime picture. You know, it's not a World War II movie, but it's a World War I. So there's a lot of that. There's certainly now a great history to it. So if anybody's looking for a reason to watch this movie, you like any one of those five things that we just mentioned, and it's in this one. So it's worth the 90 minutes or so to check it out.
Yeah, absolutely. So as we kind of wrap up here, Craig, final thoughts on The African Queen?
Just go out and, you know, revisit it again after listening to this, and you will be well spent your time. And it's just a really fun way to watch two actors at the top of their game doing some really great work.
Yeah, absolutely. Eric, any more final thoughts?
Yeah, I agree with that sentiment a lot. So we mentioned it's got a whole lot packed into it. It's a pioneering movie, but at its core, it's a masterclass in acting. So if you're no great fan of anything else other than really, really great acting, go watch this movie.
Yeah. It's a movie that's going to, like I said before, appeal to everybody. If you're a lover of just quality cinema, you'll like it. If you're a lover of, you know, just a movie that you can kick back and enjoy for the entertainment of it, you can do that as well. The only time two of these, you know, iconic actors work together, and it's authentic because you can see that they're there. You know, there's not much fakery about it. Everything is natural. And it's just a fun movie to watch. And it's a movie where you like these two people, and you can't say that much about, you know, all the protagonists in every movie. You actually like them and you like spending time with them. So this Thanksgiving, if you're looking for something to watch, you know, give The African Queen a try, because really there aren't any Thanksgiving movies. So,
and Trains, Planes, and Automobiles. Man.
Well, yeah, there's one.
and we do this for the love of it. We're not supported by anyone, but I found this movie right now is streaming. If you're an Amazon Prime member, you can stream it there free or for whatever your Amazon Prime membership costs. So it should be an easy one to get a hold of.
Yeah, absolutely. I will say before we all get off here, I should tell you that sometime in the upcoming year, you need to have my wife on because really, I don't know that she probably likes you two more than she likes me. So
yeah, I'd say that too.
So you're two of her favorite people. And so you need to make sure you have her on as a third person sometime down the road here.
Yeah, it's been a
long time. Would you care to share? She's going to be a little bit busy here in the month of December for a very important reason. You want to share that?
Great. Absolutely. She's playing Mary Bailey in It's a Wonderful Life radio play in Springfield, Illinois. So thanks for the occasion to plug that, Eric. So you can
check
that out.
Hey, this is the classics. That's a classic. So
absolutely. So hcfta.org for your tickets. But she's extremely excited about that and really starting to get into the season.
Yeah, that's fun. Too bad we've already done that.
We could. Yeah, right.
Eric, anything new going on with you?
Oh, lots new for me. So I'm involved. People who listen to this podcast may not know I'm involved in Capital City Improv, which is a improv troupe local to Springfield, Illinois. And we've got a show coming up on December 14th called the Ha Ha Holiday Show. Same website, hcfta.org. You can get some tickets to see a funny improv show there.
Awesome. And Craig, what's going on with Beyond the Mouse?
We're doing a lot. So I don't always know when these things are dropping. So we either will be or have already released our full disclosure of Frozen 2. And I either have already been impressed or will be impressed by Frozen 2. I can tell you that.
Well done.
And then we are looking to do a live show sometime in December and just talk about Disney parks and what it's like to be there in the holidays. Just exciting stuff. And actually, if you do have Disney Plus, we just released an episode all about what we are looking forward to watching on Disney Plus. Brett and I gave you some ideas for right now. Vanessa went off script a little bit and gave us some ideas for the future. But definitely check some of that out because some great content on there. Talk about Jungle Cruise. Go watch the Imagineering story. They're doing a 6-part series. And you'll appreciate this, Brandon. It's directed by the granddaughter of Ub Iwerks. Mm. So it's just really cool. Just bringing in that whole Disney history and you get to see it all on Disney Plus. Not to do another plug, Eric. You brought up Amazon, so I had to bring up Disney Plus.
Yeah. We have that equal time rule, right?
That's right. We don't need to talk about the, you know,
the other big red one. No,
the other big red one in the corner here.
Awesome. Well, for before 2019 wraps up, me being the classics guy, I've got to talk about the 80th anniversary of 1939. So Jeremy and I are working on something a little different, some kind of narrative style where I can discuss the different studios and what they were presenting during that very popular year and why that year is kind of the pinnacle of Golden Age Hollywood movie making. I know earlier in the year, Lou discussed 1994, but I think 39 can give 94 a little room for its money. So I'll be discussing that. And also I may pull out another holiday show. I got to think about that and see if we've got time to do that. There's still a couple good Christmas movies we haven't talked about yet. So keep an eye out for that, but definitely 1939 sometime before the end of the year. So once again, thanks, guys. This was a fun movie to talk about, and I'm always glad to talk to you, Eric and Craig. Let's not have it be another year before you're on again.
Yeah, I'll come on anytime to just listen to you talk intelligently about movies. It's a change of pace for me, so anytime.
Awesome. Well, like we say all the time, you can find us on Facebook, on Twitter. You can find us at FRNpod.com. Correct.
There we go.
I always, the last time I think I did our old website and I caught myself. But yeah, any type of social media, you can see what we're doing. You know, we just did our great 500th episode. We all had a blast there. So a lot of good things going on. So just keep
Eric your eye was on. A guest there as well. And you can also find us on nprillinois.org as well. So just a lot of really fun things happening with the network in as a whole.
Absolutely. So once again, we thank you for listening, and please go out and give The African Queen a try. If you haven't seen it, you won't regret it. And for the front row, I am Brandon Davis. And
I'm Eric Flick.
I'm Fred McFarland.
And we will see you in the front row.
This episode is a production of the Front Row Network, a proud Community Voices member of National Public Radio, Illinois. For more information and to see the full slate of Front Row Network shows, you can visit frnpod.com or nprillinois.org. You can also find and follow us on social media by searching for the Front Row Network on Facebook and Instagram, and Front Row Reviews with a Z on Twitter.